Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Today, our guest is Peter Ross Range, author of 1924, The Year That Made Hitler, published in January of this year by Little Brown. Mr. Range is a journalist and writer. He's worked for Time Magazine, U.S. News and World Report. His work has included presidential politics, the Vietnam War, the Berlin Wall. He's been published in the New York Times Magazine, the Sunday Times, among others. 1924 was more than a pivotal year for Hitler. It was the year that shaped a future that we wish had never happened, a future born of hatred and megalomania. In 1924 was the year that gave the Führer time to reflect, to write Mein Kampf, which is recently available to the Germans for the first time, and to solidify his thought process and his design for a nation and a world that was anathema to all that good people, if you will, good people, hold dear as ideals for a safe, good, and healthy world. How all this happened is the subject matter of Mr. Range's work. I guess the simple and most logical question with regard to interpretation of this work is, why is 24 the year? And so with that, I'd like to go ahead and introduce you to Peter Ross Range. Thank you so much, Peter, for joining us today.
My pleasure, Sam.
So I guess, you know, the title pretty much says what it is. So I guess the first question to ask you is, why is 1924 the year that made Hitler?
Let me answer it in the negative first. Let's see what could have happened instead of what happened. What could have happened is that the Hitler phenomenon could have gone away. Hitler had just staged in late 1923 a putsch, that is to say, a coup d'etat, which started in a beer hall, which was not a drunken brawl or anything like that. They had political meetings in beer halls in Munich all the time, and that's where this event was taking place. He staged a coup. Within 17 hours, it had totally failed. 15 of Hitler's men had been killed in a square in Munich. Four police troops and one bystander also killed. Hitler injured when he was jerked to the ground by one of the dying men. Badly dislocated shoulder, had to go on the lam, was captured in 2 days, dragged off to prison for an uncertain future, and went into a suicidal depression where he might have stayed for a long time. The Nazi movement was effectively over. The party was banned, the party newspaper was banned, and Hitler would subsequently be banned from speaking, although at that moment he did not know if he would ever get out of prison. He could have gotten life in prison for committing treason, high treason. So Hitler could have become a guy that you and I never heard of, and nobody else, through those events. Instead, Hitler was able to turn himself out of his suicidal depression with the help of some people who came in to talk to him, and went on a kind of a megalomaniac tear inside the prison and inside his own head, preparing himself for what amounted to the biggest beer hall speech of his life, namely his opening speech at his trial. But I'm jumping ahead of the story a little bit. But this sort of, in a reverse sort of way, answers the question, Sam, of why, because Hitler was able to change his mood and get on top of his game, so to speak, become the megalomaniac that he was, he firm up this famous hard will of his, he was then able to go on and become the dictator of Germany 8 years later.
It's funny, I was really glad that you put the photographs in the book, because they're very telling, because I thought, here he is in this prison cell that was 6x6 and on a metal bed with no blanket and all that. I was thinking, you know, all this deprivation is what gave rise to his ability to write this work out of the depths of his depression. But then when I looked at the pictures, his prison was like nicer than my house. And the picture of him sitting there drinking tea and reading the newspaper with that crocheted thing on the wall behind him and his birthday party and all that, it wasn't so bad. I can't understand how you could be depressed in that situation, but of course he was crazy. But did you, before you began your research, or before, this must be a long time ago, did you ever think that he really was just kind of in jail? Or did you, explain how the prison worked and how there was this outbuilding.
Well, there was a weird thing in German law, and that time called Fortress Arrest, which really, forget about the fortress, there was no fortress. That was an old-timey expression used 200 years ago when guys were put in prison for honorable crimes like dueling, and they were stuck in a fortress somewhere. But it stayed in German law even after the fortresses were gone, that they had honorable imprisonment for crimes of honor, and certain political crimes, even up in, including assassination in one case, were considered to be crimes of honor. So the prisoners had these cells, like you saw in the picture in the book, that were more like junior college dorm rooms. As you said, Hitler had a little wicker chair. He could drink his tea and surrounded by some flower pots. They had the run of the garden 6 hours a day, didn't have to wear prison clothes, got better food than regular prisoners. But the windows did have bars. The doors were locked at night. They were in prison. Nonetheless, if you had to invent a situation in which you had nothing to do but think and reflect on the error of your ways and consider your future options and then write some of those thoughts down, you could hardly have invented a better situation. And that's what it was like for Hitler in Landsberg prison.
He seemed, you know, obviously all of the pejorative words you could use to describe him, especially your sources when you talk about, you know, when the gentleman comes in to try to have him end the hunger strike, he's, you know, he has to watch out for all the spittle that's coming out of Hitler's mouth as he's vehemently spouting his beliefs. Or when at the putsch, failed putsch, people looked at him and saw this look in his eye that was like the look of a, almost like a rabid dog. And then you think about these things, but then he seems almost sniveling at times at the prison because, you know, he has a 9-day hunger strike, and he bemoans his fate, and it's a side of him that maybe I thought existed, but you explain it fairly, you know, very you can actually visually see him, and I was wondering, you know, whether this was a side of him that continued on after his imprisonment.
Yes, you mean the mad dog quality?
Yeah, that.
Absolutely. Yeah, Hitler was famous for his extremes. He was an all-or-nothing guy. Disaster was on the horizon, or total victory was just ahead, one or the other. There was nothing in between. He threatened suicide 3 times during the night of the putsch, as a matter of fact, when things weren't going well. He was famous for his temper tantrums all the way to the very end. If you've ever seen a movie called The Downfall, it's a great movie. You'll see a lot of that in the last few months in the bunker in Berlin. But all through his career, he was famous for his tantrums. And for the opposite, too, he could be ecstatic and carried away. And that's what people saw in his eyes on the night of the putsch. And that was the part that worked. And that was the part that carried others away with him. That he was such a compelling speaker and such a man with such fiery will. That's what made him popular and successful. You know, even though there were plenty of folks who said, this guy is too much of a mad dog for me, conditions in Germany, well, they vacillated quite a bit in the late 1920s, but eventually they got to be so bad that people were ready to go with the mad dog. That's more or less what happened.
So, in some ways, quite parallel to our campaign cycle this time.
Some would say. There are many, in fact, an amazing number of superficial echoes between Mr. Trump and Mr. Hitler, if that's what you're suggesting, Sam.
Well, and Mr. Trump has also quoted Mussolini, you know, I'd rather live a day as a lion than 1,000 days as a sheep. And then when he was told it was Mussolini, he goes, well, it's still a good quote, which is true, but he is quoting Mussolini.
Yes.
It's pretty funny.
But I went through and reread The Art of the Deal, the book that Mr. Trump holds up all the time as proof that he's such a fabulous deal maker, and it's sort of like his Bible. Mein Kampf became known as the Bible of Nazism in the 20s and 30s amongst Hitler's followers. Mr. Trump holds his book up almost like a Bible, and I found some striking parallels, even though they're superficial. There are quite a few of them. For instance, Mr. Trump was fascinated or obsessed for a while with the idea of building the world's tallest building on the West Side Yards of Manhattan that he had acquired. He wanted to build a 150-story building, and the project moved way far along through all kinds of turmoil and trouble. until it finally didn't work out. Well, Mr. Hitler wanted to build the world's tallest building, famously. He had it designed and had a model of it in his chancellery, designed by Albert Speer, that was so big that it would have held 17 versions of St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, by far the world's largest building. You know, both men were very spontaneous. Mr. Trump talks about listening to your gut rather than being instinctive rather than planning in his book. And Hitler was always instinctive, always made the snap decision which he felt in his gut. And I could go on. I have a long list.
Well, yeah, it's like the pledge that he does in his rally, where you raise your hand and salute to him, you know, guaranteeing your support of his. Is very, yeah. What was very interesting that I didn't know too was that I didn't realize that Mussolini had come into power prior to this year, and also that Hitler had kind of purloined the Nazi salute from him.
Absolutely. Actually, that goes back to Roman times. Mussolini had decided to copy that as a return to Italian greatness. You know, the Roman era was always held up as the moment of greatness for Italians. He did that, and Hitler's people adopted it as well.
The other thing that a couple of weeks ago I interviewed a guy who wrote this strange book. It was called When Hitler Took Cocaine and Lenin Lost His Brain. It was a bunch of different stories, but I didn't realize that Theodore Morell had prescribed, a quack doctor had prescribed, I guess later, much later on, all these drugs for Hitler, and the fact that in his meeting with Mussolini that he was like totally hopped up on all these drugs and how much it might have affected the course of the war. I had no idea.
It's possible. Certainly the business about Dr. Morell prescribing all sorts of drugs as Hitler was in pretty bad shape in the last year or so of the war seems to be true. I would be very careful about other stories. One thing that seems to happen when somebody embodies ultimate evil like Hitler, and when there are many gaps and holes in the story and in the documentation of what happened, is that all sorts of legends spring up. There are legends about, you know, and wild stories about Hitler's sexuality. There may be, I didn't see the book you're talking about, but it may be, may have some exaggerations in it. So I urge readers to read serious history and be a little, you know, the crazier the story sounds, the crazier it may in fact be. So make sure you have serious historical support when you read these things.
Well, that brings me to another question, which is, you know, there are thousands of books literally about Hitler and about his time and his compatriots and all that. What first prompted you to say, you know what, this is a subject that I don't think has been explored sufficiently? It goes back, 15 years prior to what was happening in 1939. Why did you think it was important to tell this story?
Well, partly because I had read a book called Explaining Hitler, which shows how hard it is to really explain what happened. And even the best historians admit that they haven't quite figured it out. One of the greatest historians, German historian named Eberhard Jeckel, wrote that while Germans have now been liberated from Hitler, they will never be able to get rid of him. He haunts everyday life, even now. We're talking about him today. We see traces of him in Mr. Trump. People see the rise of fascistic tendencies in other leaders like Mr. Putin. Another historian said how it happened that Hitler came to power is still the most important question of 19th and 20th century German history, if not of all German history. Given that, when I was looking at the background, I found a gap in the literature around 1924. A lot of writers sort of treat it as a vacation or as a sort of a straight line pass through from phase one to phase two of Hitler's development. You know, phase one was the revolutionary phase leading up to the putsch. For 4 years, all Hitler wanted to do was overthrow the German government. He wasn't interested in regular politics. After the putsch, when he came out of prison, he refounded the Nazi Party and became a regular, patient, long-term, long-march electoral politician. Between those two phases, 1924 was the transformative year, and I wanted to know more about it. So that's why I did this book.
Do you think, and I guess it's, as you said early on, it's like postulating things that you can't possibly prove. that no one will ever know. But do you think there was like this ephemeral moment? Do you think that there was like this moment of epiphany where things, I mean, I know that's what you're talking about in your book, but do you think there was a specific moment?
I think there were a lot of them, bits and pieces. I think one key moment, let's put it this way, one key moment was in August of 1924 when he was nearing, you know, he was well along with writing Mein Kampf, and he turned to one of his fellow prisoners, there were 40 other putschists in prison with him, and he started explaining to him his great man theory, and he started explaining that only once in great intervals of history, long intervals of time in human history, does a person come along who embodies both the practical politician and the man of vision, the political philosopher king, if you will. And without ever saying it in so many words, he meant himself. He made references at different times to Napoleon, to Frederick the Great, to Martin Luther. These were the great visionaries of history who not only had dreams, but also were able to put them into action. At this moment, we know Hitler saw himself in even more grandiose terms than he had before. He was already a megalomaniac, but it reached a new level while he was in prison and while he had time to think and reflect and write. So that would be the closest thing, I believe, to a single moment, which turned the corner. But I really believe it was a series of moments that added up to creating this new momentum that he generated as he came out of prison.
Well, you know, in your book and in other things I've read, you know, he could have been sentenced to life in prison. He could have been sent back to Austria. What were the political factors that led to this five-year term that ended up being a one-year term in a minimal, you know, like now they would call it kind of a golf course prison where you could go out and play tennis and, you know, that kind of thing?
Great question, Sam. There was no golf course or tennis court, but they could walk around in the garden, and that was there. And the younger guys did play soccer, and they did have some gym equipment donated from a local gymnastics club, so they did some sports out there in the garden. But the thing that we have to keep in mind is, you talked about the political circumstances. That's why I actually devote several chapters before the putsch to explaining the extraordinarily complex political situation in Germany and especially in Bavaria, which led to a situation where, you know, Bavaria before the putsch was almost in a state of mutiny against the rest of Germany. The army certainly was in Bavaria. Bavaria had reverted to a dictatorship right at the end, about 6 weeks before the putsch. The government itself had put itself out of business and turned its powers over to a dictator. There was a three-cornered political play going on between the government in Berlin, the government in Bavaria, and the Hitler forces over here on the side, which included General Ludendorff, the former dictator of Germany. Most people don't know this. He was the former chief of staff of the army right under Hindenburg, but he was in effect the dictator of Germany in the last 2 years of World War I, and now he's in league with this crazy beer hall speaker named Hitler. So you've already heard enough for me to stop and just let that sink in. That's how complex it was leading up to the putsch. And as in this atmosphere, especially in Bavarian right-wing atmosphere, the judge who was appointed to run the trial already had a known right-wing nationalistic record and sympathetic to groups like the Nazis. And in fact, he'd given Hitler parole for a small sentence he had gotten 2 years earlier for breach of the peace. And so he was quite sympathetic and allowed Hitler the run of the courtroom. So the situation was pretty well set for Hitler to get the minimal sentence of 5 years.
Well, it's funny because even if you think of just the Treaty of Versailles and the hyperinflation, along with the myriad of other circumstances that made Germany feel like it was being trod under the boot of Europe after the humiliation of World War I. And then if you jump forward to, say, 1940-something, and you have this cult of personality between four men who essentially ran the world in one sense or another, whether it was Hitler, Churchill, Stalin, or Roosevelt. So the question, it begs the question of whether time makes the man or man makes the time. And it seems as if, in Hitler's sense, it was a combination. It's a silly comparison, but it's like the Beatles. You know, these four guys came together. Nobody else has done it since. They just all happened to bring a certain something, and then they became magical, and we'll never forget them. So was there a combination of... Did Hitler have the prescience? Yes, he did, I guess, to see what was happening and to jump into that gap to fill it, or was it more the time itself that was willing and able to choose a man, even if it was a private who didn't look Aryan in the slightest, had a silly mustache, and was like a mad dog?
I tend to think that Hitler shaped the times. Hitler was the tail that wagged that dog. You know, Stalin, Roosevelt, and Churchill didn't have to do what they did until Hitler acted first. I mean, Hitler started the war. Hitler created the circumstances under which they had to do what they ended up doing. You know, you can argue that the times made the man in 1932-33 because, first of all, you had the Depression, and without the Depression, Hitler probably would never have come to office. That created a situation in which the Nazis could become the strongest party in 1932. Then a series of very odd factors played out over the next few months after the November election of 32, which finally, after 2 months, put the president, Hindenburg, in a position where he reluctantly offered the chancellorship to Hitler. And once that bridge was crossed, you know, the thing was set in motion and never stopped until the end. But with Hitler as the driving engine. So it's a combination, I guess, of these factors, you have to admit.
What about, again, comparing to, I'll just say, certain politicians today, the fact that he practiced in front of a mirror, he basically had a coach to show, to demonstrate to him the gestures that he should make when he's giving, like Fidel Castro, 3-4 hour speeches, you know, the hands moving up and down in parallel, reaching out, the hair being, you know, like swinging side to side. How much of that, one, made a difference, and how much did he consider it important in his impression?
Hugely. Huge. To quote a certain politician, it was huge. he understood very early on that it was all about moving the masses. Hitler was obsessed with the masses. He didn't call them the workers. The communists were obsessed with the workers. And then you had the so-called bourgeois parties, the traditional parties, including social democrats for that matter, who were focused on, in many ways, on the middle class. Hitler wanted to start a mass movement. He always called it a movement, not a party, as much. And he had absorbed lessons written in a book 75 years earlier by Gustave Le Bon in France about mob psychology. And he was open about this. In Mein Kampf, he says very denigrating things about the masses. He calls them the lower strata, and they only can deal with one idea at a time, and you have to keep it ruthless and brutal. They won't deal with half measures or weakness. You know, you never say something is partly true, everything is 100% true or 100% wrong. So he was a master of mob psychology and a master of propaganda. That was his great trick. And excuse me, he came up with techniques very early on. For instance, well, the wearing of uniforms and the impressive use of flags and music. Others did this on the right wing as well, but he did it bigger and better. He always entered to make his speeches. He entered from the rear of the hall after his introduction, right through the middle of the crowd, you know, with his arm raised up, you know, with a fiery look in his face. People could see him up close, whereas traditional speakers were already on the stage or they came from behind the curtain, just to give you one small example. So Hitler was a master of moving the masses, and we know where that took us.
There's a lot of very simple things if you are amoral or immoral that you can do. And, you know, one is to keep the people in perpetual fear, which is, again, might be applied to our certain circumstances today. The other one is the kind of shock and awe tactic that Cheney co-opted supposedly in Iraq. And then, you know, you have this recapitulated in like books like 1984, where you can just daily change the enemy. And it's not that hard to do if you are ruthless and you don't care about the masses. And do you feel like what he was doing, and I know I'm jumping ahead of the topic of your book, and I'm sorry, but do you feel like those tactics, and do you think it's been used by other countries, the whole playbook, is that playbook still being used today in the world?
Hard to say. And that's a big question, the whole world.
I know, sorry.
The whole of history since then. But we do know, you know, that Hitler and especially Goebbels pioneered some stuff that has stuck with us. I'll give an example. Hitler and Goebbels invented the airborne whistle stop tour. A whistle stop tour, as you know, comes from the tradition in American politics of running around on a train and speaking off the rear compartment, the rear car of the train, the caboose, to a crowd of people in a local community, stopping the train, a whistle stop at every little place along the way, and reaching out to a lot of people that way instead of getting on a little stump like Abraham Lincoln had to do, one stump per town, one speech per day. Hitler was able to do 6 or 8 speeches per day all over Germany by flying around in small airplanes. Nobody had ever done such a thing before. It was considered undignified. And they would assemble these big crowds at airports. And in those days, it was still kind of exciting to go out to an airport and watch a plane land and watch somebody get out of the plane and then say something. So they pioneered that. Plus, you know, as everybody knows, there's the theory of the big lie. There's also the theory of repetition. If you say it over and over and over again, people will start to believe it. Goebbels firmly believed all those things, and so did Hitler, and they did those things. And if you look at the basic techniques of advertising today, I'm not going to say that there are big lies out there. I don't think that really would work to a modern educated audience. But repetition certainly works. And a lot of color and a lot of music and a lot of drama. We may have inherited some of that from these fiery times in the 20s and 30s of this kind of electoral politics in Germany and Italy.
What about, going back to the book, which I guess I should be going back to, what about his speech at the trial? Was that like the kindergarten of the beginning of his training in making this type of argument?
Actually not, but it was one of the high points. He had been making many of the same arguments in his speeches already. He was already way over the top and heavily influenced by anti-Semitic books that he had read and by these grand themes of history and by his own dreams of being another Napoleon. He had already talked about that even in the months leading up to the putsch. So he had the bits and pieces out there before, but this was a rare situation where he could put it all together in this courtroom, and that speech was either 2.5 hours long or 4 hours long, depending on which source you believe. In any case, it took up a whole afternoon in the courtroom, and a lot of people thought it was fantastic. I've read it several times, and, you know, he basically does the grand sweep of history and justifies everything that he has been doing and saying. He declares himself in the first paragraph an absolute anti-Semite and explains that in terms of his early years in Vienna growing up, and denounces everything that the Weimar Republic government has done since 1918, and explains why the whole approach to World War I was mistaken, and all kinds of things were mistaken, and mentions his new attitude towards German colonization. So it is a kind of a mini foretaste of what we end up getting in 782 pages in Mein Kampf. And it carried people away, and he did it again on the last day of the trial as well. He had a big speech that lasted a couple of hours in which he positioned himself, he put himself in a position that he would be the hero regardless of the verdict, saying the goddess of history, no matter what you decide, the goddess of history will declare us innocent. you know, a thousand times over, even if you put us in prison. So so these were pretty grand speeches, and they set the stage for his heroic style comeback.
What about the fact that, you know, we're talking about the year in which he wrote Mein Kampf, and I know you've written about this too, about Germany now being allowed to, you know, purchase the book and read it, because I know you wrote an article about it. Wasn't it in the Times, or where was it?
Washington Post. Yeah.
Washington Post. Yeah. So why don't you tell the listeners? I read it, but why don't you tell the listeners in your own words how you feel about that?
Yeah. There's a lot. There's several myths surrounding this. First of all, Mein Kampf was never banned in Germany. It was the copyright to Mein Kampf was assigned after the war to the Bavarian government. The Americans were the occupying power. They took Hitler's estate and then at a certain point assigned it to the Bavarian government to administer. You know, the American army has no business being in the copyright trade and all that. The Bavarian government, in its own wisdom, decided for 70 years never to republish or allow Mein Kampf to be republished in Germany. A lot of people thought this was a mistake. A lot of scholars, even the president of Germany in 1959, said this book should be taught in the schools. You know, we need our kids to see this and understand. The better to understand the evil, the better to understand the devil. If you just shut your eyes, how are you going to learn anything? But it was considered too much of a political hot potato. But the scholarly community, the historians, including many, many Americans, including many Israelis and Jews, I interviewed a bunch of those folks 2 years ago when I began this project, felt that this needed to be out there. I mean, this is, after all, the seminal document of Nazism, for goodness sakes. And everything else Hitler ever said, which included every bad thought that he ever had in Mein Kampf, had already been published in the form of his speeches. And his speeches and other all of his writings, everything that we could lay, that historians can lay their hands on, that has been, that was preserved, has been published. There was a great book that contained all the notations up to 1924, and then a new series was started after 1925 by a research institute. It now has 17 volumes.
Wow.
So, finally, I'm sorry this is taking so long.
No, this is interesting.
Finally, on the first day of this year, 2016, the copyright ran out. Under German law, it lasts 70 years after the death of a writer. The book Mein Kampf went into the public domain. Anybody can publish it. You can publish it, Sam. I can publish it. But the scholarly institute most interested in this topic saw the day coming. They began in 2009 preparing an academically commentated and annotated version of the book. The book was finally published 2 months ago. It's 2,000 pages long, two volumes. It weighs 12 pounds. It's oversized. It's like the size of an Encyclopedia Britannica volume. I have it and have read a lot of it and marked a lot of it already. It deconstructs Mein Kampf beautifully in a scholarly way, in a historical way, showing the origins of the thoughts and why some of his sentences, where they come from, his thoughts, and why they don't make sense, or why they're true, or why they're half-true. It's a wonderful demythologizing and defanging, if you will, of Mein Kampf. The book has really no power left once you've started reading the footnotes, and you can't read this thing like a normal book because it's interrupted by footnotes every couple of sentences. There are 1,200 pages of annotations to go with 800 pages of Hitler. So you see, it's really more of a scholar's book than Hitler's book. Anybody who is a right-winger who really wants, you know, to be a neo-Nazi and read Hitler in the raw can get it for free off the Internet in a PDF download.
Wow.
I did that when I was doing my research. I have it right here in my computer. That's how it's much easier for me to work with that, for the raw copy. And it's been that way for, you know, ever since the Internet started, and the Bavarian government knew that they could not fight that. They can't fight the Internet. So they did not try to fight that. They only prevented the printing. This new volume has now been printed, as I said, two books, 2,000 pages. It cost $65, and it has indeed, surprisingly, become a bestseller in Germany. 33,000 copies sold in the first 2 months, a shock to everybody. I think this is a good thing. I think this shows that Germans are still curious about, or very curious about their past. This is a big gap that needed to be filled, because Mein Kampf was considered taboo, even though it wasn't really banned. A lot of people, you could sometimes find it in old bookshops. It was perfectly okay to buy it and have it. People had it, in some cases, in their attics, inherited from their grandparents or whatever. But it wasn't read and it wasn't taught. And now the education establishment in Germany has decided it's very important to use this new scholarly book to teach it in the high schools and the universities.
How would it be genreized? How would it be classified? Memoir?
Reference book. Reference book.
No.
You mean the new version?
No, the source material, the actual book, Mein Kampf. Would you call it a memoir? Would you call it fiction, nonfiction, literature, biography, a diatribe?
It's an autobiographical political manifesto.
Okay. What do you think of it in terms of its quality, the skill of the writer? Because when I've tried to read it, I find it so non-compelling.
Yeah. I guess you have to be on Hitler's wavelength to want to read the whole thing. I mean, I read it only for professional reasons, and I've read it in German and in English. There are moments when he can kind of sweep you away. You understand why it had a strong effect on some people. And then there are other moments where you're just totally lost. He's trying to explain things from too many different directions. He's repetitive. He's extreme. He gives no sourcing, no footnotes, hardly mentions any other sources in his whole book. So it's kind of frustrating. It has been denounced many times as terrible writing. I'll leave that, I'm quoting, I speak fluent German, but I'm not a German, so I leave the judgment on the quality of the writing to others, to Germans, and they say in many, many instances that it's terrible writing. The guy never finished high school, remember, and his prose is bloated and is full of self-importance and repetitive, as I said. So in the beginning, it sold mainly to his direct followers. It didn't have much grand sweep. It sold about 10,000 copies the first year. And the second year, and it was published in 1925, the first volume, 1926, the second volume. Only in late 1928-29 did he begin selling a lot of books, and because the Nazis were then riding the wave of dissatisfaction of the Depression, and began to, late 1929 and 1930 especially, the Nazis became the second largest party, started selling well, and by the time Hitler took power, in January 1933, it had sold 250,000 books. By the time he died, it had sold 12 million books.
Oh, my God. I had no idea.
He was a rich man.
It's fascinating because, once again, and you've mentioned them, there's so many parallels to things that are going on today. Because if you said, as you said, he never completed high school, and he had his job as a painter and a... And so what's, in your investigation of him, which is obviously quite comprehensive in your readings, how would you classify him? Suppose you were a psychologist or a psychiatrist or a high school counselor or his teacher. What skills did he have? Obviously the dramatic skills. What other skills did he possess? Like if you were going to say he was great at math, he was great at literature, he was great at...
Well, he had a very quick mind. He had, according to all accounts, he had a prodigious memory, and he had an ability to gloss over the gaps in his knowledge, and to take what some scholars believe was very superficial knowledge and make it look deep. There's great debate among scholars about what Hitler really read and what really influenced him. He would have us believe that he read everything. He claimed to have read 500 books in one little bookshop in Vienna. People who were close to him quoted him as saying he had read all of Schopenhauer and Nietzsche and Goethe and Schiller. People talk about him reading Shakespeare. And yet other investigators, other researchers have poked holes in all this and suggested, and these are the very best biographers like Sir Ian Kershaw, suggested that Hitler got a lot of his knowledge from secondary sources like brochures and pamphlets and cheap little nationalistic newspapers that he picked up in the all-night cafes of Vienna, and that if you just you could just memorize certain passages of these things pretty easily and make it sound like you had read the whole book. And there are other pieces of evidence which suggested that he did that, but he was able to then regurgitate a lot of these bits and pieces that he had cherry-picked as though he were saying them, as though it was original. Now, the beauty of this new Mein Kampf, the scholarly edition that has been deconstructed by the scholars, shows that nothing was original. Everything came from somewhere else, but he didn't say that. Hitler didn't provide any sources or footnotes. The new edition does that, and we see, oh, yeah, well, Hitler didn't think that up. That was in the literature for 30 years before he wrote Mein Kampf. So, let's see, I've forgotten exactly, well, his strengths.
Yeah.
You combine that with this fiery oratory and this utterly messianic sense of himself as the savior of Germany, and you can get a pretty compelling guy who can move masses of people. And he also, by all accounts, you know, he had a charming side. He could come across as a sophisticated or at least very charming guy in social settings that required that, you know, when he was not talking to the masses, but rather to the leading industrialists and the social elite. He knew how to pull it off. And he had a great following, for instance, among women, especially at the higher levels, who then became, in some cases, his patronesses, who provided him with money when he needed it, and cars and things like that. So Hitler was a very seemed to have an agile mind and an agile political touch.
It was interesting. What's the name of the woman whose house he ran to when he was attempting to avoid arrest?
And that was the Helena Hampstengel, the villa of Ernst Hampstengel, a German-American, about an hour south of Munich.
And then when he laid his head in her lap, and afterwards she told her husband that he was a complete neuter as a man.
Right. Yeah, you know, this is one of those, we get over into the area of sexuality. There are
right.
a lot of myths and legends, but it is widely believed that Hitler was either a neuter or something close to it, even though he, you know, for more than 10 years had an intimate relationship with Eva Braun, whom he married in the last days of the war. But, you know, he did not show much interest in women for most of his life, except for this one relationship, and was considered very odd in that way. But Hitler also was very political about it. He said, I can never marry, because if I do, I'll lose the women's vote.
Hmm.
In other words, he saw bachelorhood as a political tactic, and it seems to have worked. By remaining Germany's most eligible bachelor throughout some key years, that seemed to make him very attractive to women voters, who, by the way, were very, very numerous in those days. The Germans were early in obtaining women's suffrage, and it was very, very effective. They turned out in large numbers to vote.
Well, you know, even though we've gone a little bit astray from the book, I found the book absolutely fascinating, and I want to thank you for coming, you know, by today and talking to me about it. It's like I said, I mean, there are so many books about Hitler, but this is an area which has not been well explored, and I think you did a great job of giving us a lot of new insight, so I really appreciate you being here today.
Thank you, Sam. I enjoyed talking with you.
Likewise. That was Peter Ross Range talking about his new book, 1924, The Year That Made Hitler. It's a fascinating story because I never knew anything about it. I knew about the failed beer hall putsch, but I never knew about the prison he was sent to or how plushy it was. And I never knew that, you know, he went on a hunger strike. He was kind of a baby. He went on a hunger strike, but it lasted 9 days. He lived in this, like I said, his prison cell, if you look at the pictures in the book, were very pleasant, sitting behind a table in a chair, reading the newspaper, having a cup of tea, going out and looking at the gardens. Those are things I had no idea about. But obviously, Mr. Range has a voluminous knowledge of all things Hitler, and it's really interesting to hear him talk about his skills, his methods, and bringing it forward not that I would do it in exactly the same way, to today's political process and what's going on in the United States as we speak. So in any event, thank you so much for coming by today and listening to Mr. Range discuss his book. And we have coming up this guy, Fergus Bordowich, to discuss his book, The First Congress, kind of a corollary, how James Madison, George Washington, and a group of extraordinary men invented the government. It's really, really interesting. Then we have Karan Mahajan, who will discuss his highly anticipated debut, The Association of Small Bombs, which is about why we cover what happens in Brussels, but we don't cover bombs in Baghdad or in India, Delhi, in this case, that kill many more people and are just completely put on page 24 of the newspaper, if at all. And then we have National Book Award and Pulitzer Prize finalist Adam Hazlett discussing his latest novel, Imagine Me Gone, which is, just like Everyone Brave is Forgiven, a great book and one that I would highly, highly recommend. So for a complete schedule, as always, visit us at wellingtonsquarebooks.com, WCHE1520.com, or you can simply download our podcast at iTunes or Podomatic. Thanks so much for joining us here on The Avid Reader, and we look forward to talking with you and another great author again next week.